What's up, everybody? Appreciate you checking out Urban Legends Podcast, where we interview living legends and people making legendary moves. But yo, I just got on Patreon. That's right, Justin Hyers is officially on Patreon. Man, I'm showing y'all everything. Exclusive content, behind the scenes footage of the podcast, behind the scenes footage of me at the music studio, behind the scenes footage of me and my friends and my family life. It's crazy. This is exclusive footage and content you're not going to find on any other site. It's only available on Patreon. Uncensored, unfiltered, pure comedy gold. Patreon, Justin Hyers. Now, check out the latest episode of Urban Legends Podcast. What's up, man? Welcome to Urban Legends Podcast. We got Roy Wood Jr. in the building. I've been following this guy for such a long time, and I want you to know, Roy, I created this platform because I wanted to celebrate people that I consider living legends and people I consider are making legendary moves out here in the industry. You from The Daily Show, This Is Not Happening, Space Force on Netflix, your Comedy Central specials, Father Figure, No One Loves You, Sullivan and Son, upcoming movie.
Man, you got to go all the way back to the Comedy Union.
Oh, okay.
We know each other from, brother. You got to go back to the roots.
To the roots.
You know this brother from Pico and La Brea, around the corner from Roscoe's, with a nigga selling incense.
Hey, how you feeling? Do you still go to the Union?
I have not been to the Union. I left L.A. in 2015. And even when I was still in LA, I would swing by the Union every now and then. And, you know, it's a great place for opportunity for a lot of black comics who don't get a lot of looks at the mainstream clubs. And, you know, the J Spot, I would even put in that same bucket. I'm not even sure if the J Spot is still open or if it's
I think they just closed.
God damn it, man.
Yeah, that was my first club that I was a regular at.
The thing that's always rubbed me the wrong way at black clubs, and I know why this is a policy, but it's always rubbed me the wrong way, is that them niggas charge the performers full price for drinks.
Yeah, straight up.
And it ain't just LA clubs. I'm putting Uptown in Atlanta. I bombed at Uptown one time, and then they brought me my tab. I'm like, that's fucked up. I was still up there working.
Let me get a courtesy drink.
No. Not at them black clubs.
What's the toughest? Hey, but is Uptown black owned, or is that it's just a black club? Because people need to know there's a difference.
It's a black club. Gary Abdo is who I had always worked with over at Uptown. And, you know, black staff top to bottom, but I think Gary was at the top of the food chain, you know.
Gotcha. So
not black owned in that sense.
So I want to go deep into like your background and all that stuff, because I wanted to create this platform so people your fans can really know about you, and people that don't know about you can really, you know your upbringing and where you came from. Now, when I was doing my research, I saw you was raised in Alabama and Tennessee, but for some reason I always felt like you had a origin in Chicago. Why is there a certain reason why I had that feeling?
You know why? Because I'm a Cubs fan.
Okay.
Because I'm always wearing Cubs shit, because that's just who I root for in baseball. But that's because my dad had a lot of professional roots in Chicago. My pops used to do a radio show with Ernie Banks. So, you know, that was, you know, if you was going to watch baseball in the house, it was going to be the Cubs. That's just what it was. But no, I always been down south. I was born in New York, but like at a year old, we moved to Memphis, and by the third grade we was in Alabama.
Gotcha. And did you experience like racism down there in the South, or not really? It wasn't as bad as, you know.
Oh yeah, I mean, on the day-to-day, here's the thing, like in every racist city there's safe zones, if that makes sense. You know what I'm saying? Like I grew up on the west side of Birmingham, so it's predominantly black. We moved during the bulk of white flight.
You know, for anybody that don't know, white flight is when white people moved away from Negro lived in
the
places.
In the mid to late 80s during the crack boom, and black people, the first wave of black people with a little bit of money to buy a house, started buying houses in then white neighborhoods that became black neighborhoods because white people bounced to the suburbs. And so there wasn't much racism where I grew up, but then, you know, Birmingham is an 80% black city just by nature. But then the moment you go over to the suburbs, or you go to the mall, and where all the commerce was on white sides of town in Birmingham, still is for the most part. So that's where you get called nigga and get followed around the store and get pulled over a lot when you're in high school. And, you know, I remember in high school when we would play schools out in the county, out in the more rural parts of the state, you know, it was nothing for a motherfucker to just mumble nigga under his breath while he ran past you at first base. I'm like, can we just play baseball again?
Nigger!
Nigger, hit the ball, Clayton, nigger. And then take off running.
Hey, shout out to them white boys being disrespectful. Yeah. You know what city that I find to be very racist, undercover, and it's New York City.
Oh, the whole East Coast is on that undercover racism shit.
Yeah. I didn't realize that until I started performing up there, trying to do my racial material. And then I was like, oh, y'all are so liberal that you're actually racist because you're ignoring, you're trying to ignore race or something. It's a weird thing that goes on. There's this co-opting
of the black struggle that happens in the Northeast with a lot of white liberals, and it's, some of it is in good spirit. Your intentions are good. But my nigga, this is my story. This is my narrative. I get to tell the story the way that I want to tell the story. You're not going to tell me what is right or wrong to say about my black experience. And I think that's what I see a lot of happening in New York. You know, it's anytime you start a joke that's anywhere about race,
they tighten up automatically.
But down south, niggas be like, niggas say that shit. And even the rednecks be like, yep, that's how we be.
That's so true. That I it was so crazy. Like, I did a show in Indiana and all my racial material was hitting. Cause they're like, you're right, nigga. We are racist and we are proud of it. You motherfucking jigaboo. Thank you. They were happy that I was saying this shit. But in New York, they're like, no, that's crazy. We don't think that way. It's like, you fucking do think that way.
Yeah, it's wild to see it set up like that. But, you know, the good thing about New York is that comedically, you can get on stage five times in five different boroughs and basically go to five different focus groups and know what your joke hitting on by the end of the night. Whereas down south, that would probably take you a week and a half of doing consistent shows across multiple cities.
Absolutely. That's what I love about going up to New York. And that's why before COVID, I started going up there at least once a year, like in the summertime. So when did your love for comedy start? What was that moment for you? Was it a particular moment or what was it when you started falling in love with comedy?
I would say that Sinbad and Red Fox were patient zeros.
Nice. For me.
In terms of just Red Fox, I heard it because my pops had the albums, right?
The party albums.
And then Sinbad was the first time I saw it. And this is like back in the day. Nobody remembers this, but back in the day, like HBO, Cinemax, and all them joints, they would do a free preview weekend. And so once a year, HBO was free on your TV just for you to see all of the different content they had to offer. And that would be the weekend that HBO would show all the best fucking movies and all the best concerts. HBO used to show concerts and shit. And they would show a comedy special, you know, and it might be like a Lane Boozler or like somebody, you know, of that era, right? Strong comics, Gary Shandling, and they fucked around the show. Sinbad one year on the free preview, bro, it was a wrap, man. I was like, that's fun. Now, I didn't get the courage to do it till college. At this point, I was probably like 10 or 11. So
wow. It would be
a long time before I ever, you know, got the balls to actually try it. But I would say Red Fox and Sinbad. And then what sealed the deal was when Comedy Central came on the air. I guess I might have been 12 or 13. And so Comedy Central had a show called, it was one of the shows when the network launched. It was called Stand Up with Wally Collins. And Stand Up was essentially just a compilation of comedy clips from the previous week on shows. So Stand Up comedy used to come on TV all over the place back in the day, 80s.
Right.
Like there was like no less than 10 shows that showed, in addition to late night. And so I remember watching Wally Collins every week and like getting into comedy and watching all the different clips, and then AJ Jamal and all of that. And he had the A-List, which was like the more showcase style show or whatever. But I remember those two programs distinctly, because that was the only time I really veered away from sports or cartoons to watch regular TV, if you will. And
gotcha. And so you was big on in baseball. That was your your sport of choice growing up.
Everybody should play baseball for you. Everybody should wait tables and play baseball for a year. Baseball teaches you patience, man. There's no other sport where you suck 70% of the time and you are considered good. If you're only good 30% of the time in any other sport, they say you suck.
Straight up.
It's only 30% from the field shooting three-pointers. That nigga trash.
Straight up.
Quarterback only completed 30% of his passes. Trade that motherfucker.
And so was your ambition like to go to college for baseball and go to the pros? Like, was that a kid dream?
You know, it's crazy. I went to Florida A&M because I thought I could walk on to their baseball team.
That was it. I was going to ask you why you went.
Well, I'm legacy. You know, my mom's graduated from there. My father was a graduate professor of journalism there.
Wow.
But it came down to three schools. I knew I was going to go to a black college, but it came down to Clark Atlanta, Tennessee State, or Florida A&M. And so, in hindsight, for journalism, Atlanta would have been a better city. But you know when you the fuck up and you wilding. And you know what? I need to go somewhere where my mom and daddy got friends, because I need people that's going to look out for me. Which was probably the right choice, because if I've been in Atlanta with no supervision, with nobody on campus on the faculty to have my back, it'd have been a trip. Tennessee State didn't have a baseball team, so that took them off the list immediately. But I got to college, I tried out for the baseball team, got cut immediately, and then had to start figuring out my life.
Wow. Funny thing.
Like, the first time I thought about my future was walking home from baseball tryouts.
Wow. And what were you thinking in that moment?
I'm going to be amazing, man. My ass was at Shoney's 2 days later, waiting tables.
Damn.
Shout out to Shoney's. It probably ain't but three left open. Nobody even know what the fuck I'm talking about.
Right? I remember Shoney's. It was because I'm from Florida. That's why. And I went to college. I graduated from Clark Atlanta University. So I actually went to Clark. I'm in Atlanta right now.
I was close, man. I was close. I really was, you know, but, you know, it all works out for a reason. You know, I'm very thankful to the faculty and staff at Florida A&M, like I always will be. I've been on the record saying that a million times.
And so when did you say, all right, I'm going to try stand up? What was that moment when you was like, fuck it, the baseball didn't work out, so I'm finna pursue this comedy career?
So my degree was in journalism, and part of the journalism curriculum is impromptu speaking. So we had to do an impromptu speaking class. And so every week for a month, the teacher would give you, it was like an envelope, right? And then the envelope was the topic that you had to give a 5-minute speech on. Whether you knew anything about it or not, you had to talk for 5 minutes straight on this thing or whatever. And so every week I would get the envelope and open it up, go out in the hall, prep for 5 minutes, come back in and do my speech. And almost always I got a laugh. And it wasn't on purpose. I wasn't trying to. But I guess there was something natural about, I don't know, persona, stage presence, you know, aura, whatever you want to call it. Niggas just found me funny. And it got to a point where the teacher started accusing me of deliberately throwing the assignment. And I wasn't. I'm like, I'm just talking. I don't know why. But that was the first taste of, you know, standing in front of strangers and watching them respond positively to my thoughts. And I was like, okay, I think this is something that I can try and start fucking around with. Then I was stealing credit cards in college, and And so I got arrested. And before I got probation,
why were you stealing credit cards?
Because it makes money, Justin. That's why.
Okay.
You do crime for two reasons. Because it feel good or it makes you money.
Okay.
That's it.
And who were you stealing credit cards from?
Oh, I was working at the post office. So it wasn't like I was going in people's purses and shit. These were already enveloped and sealed credit cards from the bank. And that's where the community of Florida A&M comes into play. Because, you know, if I'm anywhere else, I really think I get expelled. But, you know, it takes people seeing the potential in you when you don't even see it in yourself. And, you know, probation, that was a time while I was still in school. And that's when I got focused. Like, that was like the, okay, for real, what are we doing with our life? I was like, you know what? I like that comedy shit. Let's see what the fuck that do. And I started doing stand-up, got back in school. I got suspended for a semester for that shit. And so during that suspension.
Because they knew you got arrested. That's why you got suspended.
Yeah. Campus misconduct. Because, you know, you violate student code of conduct. You got to fucking go sit down somewhere for a little while.
Gotcha.
And so during that time, that's when I went and started doing the road. I ain't have shit else to do. I ain't got nowhere else to go. So I may as well just start it. So I just started riding a Greyhound and going and doing road comedy. I still had my financial aid check. I got my Fi 8 check before I got suspended. So I was basically sitting on 6 G's with nothing to spend it on.
So wait a minute. You was doing road gigs before you really started hitting the open mic circuit, or were you already doing the open mic circuit then did the road gigs?
The road, well, okay. So here's the thing. In the South, open mic in most cities in 19, this is 98 at this point, by the way. This is my junior year, going into my junior year. Open mic is once a month in most markets in the South. It's not every week. So if you want to perform every week at an open mic, you got to get on the dog, man. So I had to get on the Greyhound and fucking go to Atlanta. Atlanta had a weekly open mic and Coconuts in St. Petersburg.
Yeah, I went to Coconuts when I was starting out on the St. Pete Beach. That's where I'm from.
St. Pete Beach.
I'm from St. Pete.
So it's right off in the cut, in that little hotel cut, the little low ceiling and shit.
Yeah.
So
my assistant even got up in Coconuts one time.
Yeah, I had a good little run.
He did stand up for like 2 weeks.
Man, you got to get back in that shit, Lee.
Stop hey, man, mess around with Jay. I probably will.
I need an opener.
Dude. So anything other than that, you had to hop the dog, bro. So Birmingham, where I'm from, open mic was once a month. That's where I went. That's the first time I touched the mic was in Birmingham. Then I got connected with a local comedy troupe in Tallahassee. That was like a little, you know, little quiet little network. Me and a couple white boys from over at Florida State, some locals who had already graduated, like every race you could name. It was just people who love comedy, niggas from 18 years of age up to like 45. And it was like 7 or 8 of us. And once a month, we put together a show in town. There was a weekend room, but you had to earn the right to get a guest set there. So that's what I spent most of 1999 doing. So when I got back in school, I already was making money on the road. Mm. I wasn't making a lot of money, but I was doing okay enough. So I stacked on my classes Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursdays so that I could have time to travel on the weekends. And I needed Monday morning to take the long ride back to Tallahassee. And that's what I did until I graduated, man. I made the dean's list the rest of the way. And when I got out of college, I graduate. And then I go to try and, you know, apply for journalism jobs and all of that shit. And I can't get hired anywhere because every summer that I should have been interning, I was fucking doing comedy.
Mm.
But at this point, my mom had chipped in to get me she put a down payment on a car. I had to keep the note. And so I was traveling doing stand-up, and the way I felt, I was like, fuck it, man. I've been doing comedy the last 2 years. That was the internship. That's the job I'm supposed to be walking into. And I did the math. I was making more doing stand-up than I would have for my first two journalism job offers.
That's right. So how was you making so much money?
I just kept doing it.
How was you making so much money only 2 years in doing stand-up? Like, When did you find your
boy? When
we're
talking so much money, I'm talking $14,000.
Nigga, and that's more than I'm making right now.
My projection, and my projection for year three after graduation, I did the math. I looked at the rooms I was working, looked at the merch that I could start selling. If I add this market, this market, this market, my projection was to make $18,500 my third year on the road. Hmm. And I figure if I supplement that with Golden Corral, I'm probably making anywhere between, you know, 25 to 28 for the year. So my first, the two journalism jobs I had, the offers were for 13.
What were what were you doing to book these rooms? Or was it just like you going there performing and then the club owner or the venue owner want to bring you back? Or were you doing something in particular to book these rooms?
Yeah, I mean, every comedy club is just a job. And you just, every job has an application process. So you just treat every club as its own individual thing. You do well in Tallahassee. The guy who books Tallahassee gonna put you in Jacksonville. If you do good in Jacksonville, that gets you Savannah. The person who books Savannah also books Columbia, South Carolina. And Columbia was, back in these days, nigga, they would book you for 2 weeks straight if you was an opener or MC. Mm-hmm. So Columbia would book you back-to-back weeks. And this was a six-night-a-week club, Comedy House Theater, or Comedy Act Theater. No, Comedy House Theater. Comedy Act was L.A. Comedy House Theater would book you six nights a week. So your only off day was Monday. So whenever I booked Columbia, and I would work Columbia every 3 months, right? And so you're working 2 weeks straight as an MC. What the fuck you doing all day during the day? You ain't doing shit. So take your bitch ass down to the fucking temp service and get a day job. So I worked 40 hours a week during the day at a Quikrete. There's a concrete packing facility in Columbia, South Carolina. And I would clock the fuck in 7:30 to 5. And then I would fucking go home, shower, get the little concrete naps out my hair, and then go tell my jokes that night. So there were enough ways to supplement your income once you were on the ground that you could get your money up. And so you show up on time, you do your job, you don't go over your time. The less you can curse, the faster you advance.
Hmm.
And so I had this, I would say ass damn hell, but if I said, what I figured out was if I, instead of cursing, if you hit it on the half syllable, then you get credit for cursing. The audience gives you credit for cursing, but the club owner, in the eyes of the club owner, you didn't curse. You know what I'm saying? Like this shit, this motherfucker. Let me tell y'all something, man.
Okay.
And so if you hit curse words on the half syllable or just the first, the audience is going to fill that in with whatever curse word they deem appropriate. And so it got me this reputation as being this clean comic, even though if you really looked at the material, it wasn't really clean. It was just, I didn't say the whole word. And so that helped, you know, that helped move me up. Also, you know, lying. a thing that I would do when I was working a room, right? Because the goal, when I first started, the goal every month was to work a new room, a new city every month.
That's a good goal.
Every month, I must tell a joke in a new city because I have to build out the South, because that's the only way you're going to do this sustainably, is to have a foot in every single market or whatever. So if I was on the way to a gig, I would call us. All right, let's say I'm doing Cincinnati. So to get to Cincinnati, I got to cut through Knoxville. I'm not working Knoxville yet, right? But then I call Knoxville and I say, yo, I'm a comic. You know, I've done Birmingham, Atlanta, whoop-de-whoop. I'm passing through on Wednesday. Can I do a guest spot real quick at your club? And more often than not, the club would say yes, because they felt like, oh, you're headed on the money. Or I would just tell them, hey, I'm auditioning for this TV show or this thing. I don't know if you could pull that lie off now because of the internet, but hey, I'm working on a big set for a TV audition for Star Search. Is it okay if I come in town and do 7 minutes? I'm headed up to Cincinnati. Mikey Kurtz at Go Bananas can vouch for me.
Yeah, okay.
And you sure have two comics that you've opened for. You put them in the email, but nobody ever calls your references, right?
Right.
So you go in town, you do Knoxville, you do the guest set. And then you drive the rest of the way that night to Cincinnati. You tell the hotel in Cincinnati, hey, I'm coming in town a little early to do media. Is it okay if I do an early check-in? Those days when you're staying in a shitty motel, the motel don't give a fuck. Like, you can't do that shit at a Sheraton or something like that. But when you staying at the fucking Motel 4 or some shit, like, they'll let you in town early.
Motel negative 8.
So you had a place to stay. So I would go, I would do Knoxville. I would tape myself. And then I would, like, take that tape and then deliberately edit the front and back end of the tape. This is a long story, but I'm just explaining to you how I was able to fucking
I appreciate it.
Shit around. So when I would go on stage in Knoxville and perform and do the guest set, let's say the guest set is 7 minutes. I'll go on stage and I'll say, give it up for Roy Wood Jr. Yeah. I come on stage, let the applause fall completely silent before I say a word. Then I would go, how y'all doing tonight? Then I would start my set. Then at the end of my joke, the last joke, I would let that joke and let the laughter fall completely silent. And then I say, thank you, good night. I wouldn't leave during the applause. I have that tape now. This also, I'm recording everything. I'm recording all of my sets. I had a little JVC VHSC joint. That shit was my motherfucking life. So when I would get back to Birmingham after my week in Cincinnati, you set up the VCRs, double deck, you run your AV cords, and you're making dubs of this Knoxville set to send to Nashville and Chattanooga and Asheville and Lexington and all the other clubs in that network that respect Knoxville tape. So I would take the Knoxville tape and edit out me walking on stage and me walking off stage. And if you edit it properly, it looks like you're watching a portion of a longer set because you never heard applause at the beginning or end. You never saw me walk on stage or leave the stage.
Gotcha.
You know what I'm saying? So it's a 7 minute tape, but I'm actually sending you 6.5 because I trimmed the fat. Then when I send that tape to Nashville and I send it to Chattanooga, I go, hey, here's a portion of me performing in Knoxville. You don't need to know it was a guest set.
Right. Right.
You could assume that it was a fucking 50-minute set or a 30-minute set. And I would do the same thing in Cincinnati. Let's say I'm emceeing in Cincinnati. That's 4 nights, 6 shows. Yeah, Thursday, 1, 2, 2, 1. Yeah. So 6 shows, right? 2 Friday, 2 Saturday, 1 Sunday. I would wear the same outfit the entire week on stage, set the camera in 3 different places over the course of the week while I'm performing.
Smart.
Then when I get home, edit it all together into a 30-minute set to make it look like a 3-camera shoot. It's very choppy. The cuts weren't smooth, but it's 30 minutes of tape because every night I did different material. So now you take that tape, and that's the tape you send to Columbus, Ohio. That's the tape you send to Cleveland. That's how you work your way up the freeway. Each city respects the city closest to it. So then I go to Cleveland and I go, hey, here's me doing 30 minutes in Cincinnati. You don't need to know that it was 10 separate fucking, that it was 3 10-minute sets.
Yo, I'm going to do that. I'm going to do that when I get back on the road. Nigga.
Zoom in and crop out the audience, though, because you can't have different people in the jump cuts.
All right. Hey, I'm doing that. That's a smart. And so when did the radio come into play? Like, how long were you doing stand-up until someone decided to let you get on air as a
this
radio?
Is all happening while radio. I'm doing radio this whole time.
So how did the radio come into play in the beginning?
I graduate 2001. I come home to Birmingham. Front half of 2002, Ricky Smiley leaves Birmingham to go to Dallas to start what was then a local morning show in Dallas, but will ultimately become the syndicated show that we know him to have today. Ricky leaves Birmingham. The radio station needs a new host. Again, this is it's lying, but you have to back it up. So I get on the radio. The way I got the job at the radio station, they had auditioned a few people and didn't really like what they were getting. And so they were kind of fed up at that point. Like, by the time I got to town, the radio station had decided that they weren't going to do any type of comedian on the show. And I go, yo, I am a stand-up comedian. I have a degree in broadcast. Fuck with me. And I'm like, So I go, how about this? D.L. Hughley is coming in town this weekend, and I know that the radio station hosts all the nigga nights at the comedy club. Like, anytime a big time black comic came to town, the morning show were the ones who went on stage and, yeah, are you ready for comedy? Listen to 95.7.
Right.
All right. I know where you niggas gonna be on Friday night. I said, if I open for DL and y'all laugh, let me come up here and intern. I'll work for free. And they said, that's a deal. So I called a comedy club where I'm open micing, but I haven't been passed on the big stage. At the Stardome, there's the comedy club Stardome in Birmingham. There's the main performance stage, and then there's a side room where the new Jacks. It's like the D League for the NBA. I'm over there in the cut in the D League. I haven't been promoted to the big stage yet. So I called a comedy club and I go, yo, I just got hired by the radio station to be the new comedian. They want me to open for D.L. Hughley. It'll just be 5 minutes. Is that cool? And the comedy club was like, yeah, cool. Congratulations.
Shout out to them.
So on the night, all I had to do was keep the club owner away from the radio DJ. And I did that. And I got on stage. I did 5 minutes. It was just one of them nights, man, where just everything worked, every syllable, every mannerism. I just fucking had them. And I walk off stage, and Buck Wild, who was the host of the show at the time, he just walked up and shook my hand. He said, see you Monday morning. Bring Chick-fil-A.
Hey, shout out to that, man.
Yeah, so long story short, while I'm doing mornings, if the gig was within 4 hours of Birmingham, I drove home so that I could be on the radio the next day. And if it was more than 4 hours, I stayed in whatever city I was performing in, get a day job during the day. But I would do all of my production work before I left town. And that's how the prank call started coming into play, because I had to do pranks to honor what Ricky had set up.
I was going to ask you what made you start. Because, see, that's when I first heard you. That's when LimeWire was popular, when you downloaded music.
Oh, shit, BearShare.
Yeah, BearShare and all that. And somebody sent me one of your prank phone calls. It's when you was pretending to be an African. And you was like, you was cussing out somebody in an African voice. Man, I thought that was the funniest fucking prank phone call I had ever heard in my life. So, man. So talk about the whole prank phone calls and how you got that kicked off and doing the, I think you did like CDs and things like that.
Yeah, I did 3 CDs of that stuff. I mean, knowing what I know now, just about cultural appropriation and just shit like that. Like, it was funny then. And, you know, black people have a different comedy code. Like, it was like, all right, that was funny for its time. There's no way I could even do that now. Like, I couldn't even try to pretend to be somebody else just to get somebody to cuss me out. But in 2001, that's what people laughed at. And so I was replacing Ricky Smiley, who was known for doing pranks. You're not going to get on the radio without doing prank phone calls. You know, in radio, it's called a benchmark. It's like a go-to segment. It's like Charlemagne's Donkey of the Day. Like, you every day, people are counting on this segment to happen.
Gotcha. And
the prank calls, you know, I'll be honest, I have a love-hate relationship with them, you know, in the long run, in terms of legacy of my career. It's the first thing that put me on. It's the first real thing I ever had go viral. And this is pre-YouTube. This is when going viral was over email, where you would get an email and it would be like 90 forwards underneath it. And you see all the people who got the email before you. What the prank calls did was open me up to other markets too, because, you know, in those days, you knew what the radio, how could I put it? There's a radio service website that shows you the ratings of pretty much every station, every market, every shift. So I could identify the cities where there were non-syndicated black radio shifts happening and they had low ratings. And what I did was I targeted radio stations in markets where I wasn't performing. The clubs who didn't respond to the VHS tapes, the clubs who never returned the email. Back in those days, it was faxes. You could fax your avails to clubs. So I identified which radio stations in those markets where I wasn't performing. Oh, this station isn't doing well. They probably need some fun content. So I would mail them a fucking stack of burnt prank call CDs.
Oh.
I send these motherfuckers 80 tracks. We ain't doing shit with them. YouTube ain't a thing. So, hey, my nigga, do me a favor. Play these pranks on your morning show and just say my name. And it's free to you. I'm not asking for anything in return. And it's free content. And they fucking did it. God bless them. All that. I was on in like 40 markets, bro. And so I let the pranks cook for 3 months. Then I would turn around and call the comedy club that wouldn't fuck with me before.
Mm-hmm.
And I go, yo, I'm on in this market. So now you're a club owner. That's business. Even if you don't think I'm funny, I can walk into a radio station that you don't advertise with and bring people to the show. So that was enough to get me booked in a lot of markets where I know I wouldn't have gotten a chance. I know I wouldn't have gotten a look. And people came out because of the prank calls. It was just, I think for me, you know, as you grow comedically, you want to do different shit. And so I think that's where kind of the thing is. It's like, I know deep down I should probably do one more prank phone call album, but that's also 20 years ago. I'm 41, man. I can't be yelling at people like I would. Like, to make a prank call good, it takes a level of recklessness.
Right.
Like, the stuff you're saying, the fact that I was never shot, physically assaulted,
I was gonna ask you,
or
that
sued by anybody that I, and we're talking well over 700 prank phone calls total over my career. I think you got to know when it's time to leave the casino.
Hey, but it's like that, you know, Jay-Z line. It's like that Jay-Z line. People want my old shit, buy my old albums. You see what I'm saying? So it's like, you know, if people still want your pranks, like, hey, go and check them out. You know what I'm saying? Because you about moving forward.
And it's dope because it's always people discovering them. What's funny is the people who still discover my pranks and think I just did them shits. I'm like, man, that prank was from 04. That nigga dead. The person right. Like, for real, people that I've prank called have died.
Are dead. Oh, okay. All right. That's not
have
that
literally
funny.
Have died. And I get emails from their families. And the one thing that is dope, though, is that It makes me sad, but it is touching when the families of people that I've pranked reach out to me after all these years and they say, that's the first thing we played at the repass.
Wow.
Because we wanted to remember something fun about it. Like, that part of it, that still touches me and makes me feel good. But yeah, I don't know if I could ever do prank phone calls again, because so much of that is just bent upon political incorrectness.
Let's get into the Daily Show. Because I feel like I would be remiss if we didn't touch on that. How did that come about? Where were you at in your career when you got that audition? And how was your audition?
That audition was good, man. It was a good audition. So the Daily Show, Trevor takes over 2015. Summer 2015, Trevor's announced as the new host. At that time, for me, career-wise, I was coming off of a canceled sitcom. And you know how that is, man. You own a show. Oh, I got a show. Ah, shit, they canceled us.
Yeah.
What the fuck I'm going to do now?
Straight up.
And you're in that, what the fuck am I going to do now part of your career? And I'm getting auditions here and there, but I'm not really booking anything, man. And I'm doing a lot of stuff on ESPN. That's the one network I will give credit. ESPN, not as much now, but ESPN used to fuck with comedians hard, man. Sports Nation and His and Hers, they would have a lot of different comics in and out of those shows. And so Neil Brennan was good friends with Trevor. Neil Brennan co-created Chappelle, and Neil dropped my name to Trevor. And that was enough, you know, to at least get me the audition. And the reason why I bring up ESPN is because doing that stuff for a year low-key prepared me. Like, that was the gym. Because sports and politics are essentially the same argument.
Right.
You really believe your side? I really believe my side.
Right.
Now let's find something funny to yell at each other. But like, that's, you know what I'm saying? Like, it's low. I would almost argue.
I mean, that's Skip and Shannon Sharp. I mean.
Yeah. Sports, I would argue that sports is harder to debate than politics. Because sports to me is just sillier. Because it's just a fucking ball.
Right.
We're yelling at each other about two niggas play with a ball. That's all it is. At least politics, it's about the fate of the nation and the future of the earth. And there's more stakes. But sports, to be that adamant about something that simple, you know? I'm not saying sports don't matter, but the actual activity is simple. You have a ball, put it in the hoop.
Right.
That motherfucker ain't the greatest to ever put the ball in the hoop. You know who the greatest? Bill Russell, motherfucker. Like that shit is so circular.
Anybody that say Bill Russell has that voice too. It's always an old Bill Russell. You'll never hear a young voice saying Bill Russell. And so what exactly was your audition? What did they make you do at your audition to land that gig?
You have to write a chat segment where you and Trevor are talking to one another about a political issue. You write an original segment, and then you perform a segment that they wrote for you. It's very base, you know. Can you perform the shit that our writers cook? And can you come up with something that's as good as what our writers do? We want to know that your brain already operates in that headspace. And for me, my stand-up at that point was turning a corner where, you know, there's A and B sides to every argument. But, you know, what I learned in my time over at ESPN as a comedian, my job is to find the third side to the argument or the angle that you didn't consider. Because ESPN got plenty of motherfuckers sitting at the desk who can argue A and B. That's their job. You know, they've either covered the sport for years or played the sport for years. So my job as a comedian isn't coming in to be A or B. My job is to come in and give you the perspective that you didn't consider. So the original segment that I wrote, there was a picture that came up in around 2015 of a black kid at a high school in West Virginia who has a Confederate flag tattoo on his arm. It's big. It's a black dude, black kid, elbow to wrists, full Confederate flag.
That's
tattoo.
The one that ran by you on the baseball field and said, nigger. That's
so, you know, black people are calling him lost. White people are saying heritage, not hate, you know, all of that. The usual argument, right? Mm-hmm. And so the angle that I presented to Trevor was that, how do we not know that this brother, he's a black man in West Virginia. He's probably scared. That shit might be camouflage.
That's funny. That's funny.
And so I tried to make the argument for things you have to wear or do to get out of a place safely. Brilliant. You know, we don't even know if that's a permanent tattoo. Nobody's asked it. Like, so that was my, I can't remember what they wrote for me, but I remember that joke getting some good laughs on the day in the audition. And that was it, man.
Hey, like, so this the,
got
this
the call
last...
before I got to the airport.
Man, that's fire. This is the last question. What have you learned from either Trevor or just being on The Daily Show as a comedian and a performer and a writer? Like, what's the biggest thing you learned, or maybe the biggest business lesson that you've learned being a part of a show like that?
The biggest lesson I've learned from Trevor is logic first, emotion second.
Tell that to every woman in America. Can you say that again?
Now look, I'm gonna let you say that too. You can get me in trouble.
Hey, it's a joke, ladies. It was a joke, everybody.
Logic first, emotions second. Because if you can walk, like it's just, there's days when you come to work and you see the news headline and just immediately you mad. Man, can you believe they did? Can you? And you're legit angry. And the problem, or the issue, at least with anger that I've found, is that I'm not able to be funny when I'm angry. But if I've laid out an argument or laid out the points of an issue first, then I can find the places to infuse the anger. And now the anger is informed. And now that's something that's far more cutting, you know, and funnier, you know. So, you know, and I'm not going to say that I nail it every time, but Trevor does it. But Trevor also came up in apartheid. So low key, everything we're experiencing right now in America, this nigga lived through. Like, he been through the shit. Like, this motherfucker was, I was born in the darkness.
Right.
You simply adopted it.
He's Bane.
Yeah. So Trevor has already been through this process. So he's able to take a step back when something incredulous happens in our administration. And he's able to dissect it from a place of calm and then take anger and use that to kind of support the thesis. But just yelling and screaming because you're angry, it's cool, but it's not as effective as figuring out plans of action and figuring out ways to show people that they're not alone in the way that they feel and trying to help people find a way through all of this. Because everybody's angry, but which one of us is going to sit down and try to figure out solutions to the issue or point out parts of the issue that you would have never considered? That, to me, is that's the ultimate job of The Daily Show, at least as I've seen it, you know, in my time under Trevor. And it's really, it's changed my comedy. It's changed how I approach life in general. You know, I try not to let emotion, like, emotions are there and they're real, and I'm not saying suppress them, but if you're not careful, when the time comes to really sit and figure out solutions, you can't get it because the emotion has overrun you.
I think that's very important for comedians to hear.
I'm just saying, man, bullshit pop at 2 p.m. and we got a show to do, and the show is due by 3. The show is due by 5 to the satellite uplink. I ain't got time to sit in the office and be mad for 2 hours and go, can you believe that motherfucker, man? We got to, no. What's the issue?
You should do a segment just like that. Can you believe? What? Right. I said, you should do a segment just like that. Just, can you believe, mother, man?
Just outrage. God damn it, I'm mad. Tell you what's mad.
God damn it, I'm mad. That might be something to that. Hey, man. Like I said, I appreciate you coming on. Like I said, I created Urban Legends Podcast to celebrate people I feel like are living legends and people I feel like making legendary moves. You're a king, brother. Keep doing your thing. Is there anything that you got that you're working on that you want to say before you peace out?
Nah, man. Just put an @ in front of my name or put a .com behind it, and that'll keep you up to date on what the fuck I'm up to.
You heard what
the fuck I can tell said. You I'm doing some shit, and then 2 weeks from now, a new disease will come and shut that down too. So, you
don't know. Shout out to that. Hey, man, appreciate you, bro. Continue. Wish you nothing but continued success, man.
Yeah, man. Respect to you, man.
Appreciate that.
Yes, sir.
Peace.